Here we are again. We're making progress and following in the Buddha's footsteps. We talked about the Sangha, first of all, and within that, you know, Buddha, Dharma, I'm sorry, we talk about the three jewels, and within that, the Buddha jewel, Dharma jewel, Sangha jewel, and then the book, after discussing the three refuges, then went on to go into more depth about the Dharma jewel, specifically true paths and true cessations. So within true paths, you have the three higher training in ethical conduct, higher training in concentration, higher training in wisdom. So we've finished talking about ethical conduct. We have that down pat, right? Yeah. Everybody keep the precepts, A1, perfect. Yeah, do your purification. Yeah, create merit. Yeah, got it right. Yeah, easy, huh? No, it's not. It's not. Okay, because we have to really deal with our crazy mind to keep good ethical conduct. But ethical conduct is the foundation for developing concentration and wisdom. Yeah. In other words, with ethical conduct, or put it this way, in the process of developing ethical conduct, you are strengthening your mindfulness and your introspective awareness. And those two mental factors are very, very important for generating concentration. Yeah. So you're strengthening those by practicing ethical conduct. Also, to practice ethical conduct, we have to deal with our ignorance, anger, and attachment in some way or another. You know, we can't just say, well, later, mañana, I'll deal with that. Because to keep good ethical conduct, you have to deal with the mind that motivates our actions. So in doing that, you know, what comes up in ethical conduct that disturbs your mind, it just so happens to be the same five hindrances that come up when you're trying to develop concentration. And so you have to get some control over those things when you're practicing ethical conduct. Otherwise, they're too strong, you know, when you start practicing concentration. So we've been in the process of discussing about the ethical conduct, and we've talked already about the various objects of meditation that can be used to develop concentration. And right now we are on the chapter about the five hindrances. Oh, goody. Yeah. And so we have already talked about the hindrance of sensual desire, the hindrance of malice. Okay. And then we did lethargy and sleepiness. Okay, so you have to wake up now. Yeah. The next one is restlessness and regret, which are put together because they have some similarities. And then the final one is doubt. Okay, so all of those are mental factors too, that, you know, we have to deal with. First of all, subduing them a little bit with our ethical conduct, and then subduing them even further. We have to do that to gain concentration. And then it's the higher training in wisdom that cuts them off. Okay, so that's where we are. Yeah. But to start the session, we usually visualize the merit field and ourselves surrounded by sentient beings. Okay. And Again, it's quite important when we take refuge and generate bodhicitta, when you're visualizing the merit field in front and you're here facing it, you're surrounded by all the sentient beings. But the people you don't like, the people you don't like, who you don't want to be around, who you think are creepy and disgusting and whatever it is, they are sitting in front of you facing the merit field. So to see the Buddha, you have to see these people because they're right in front of you. And so what this means is that in our practice, we have to make peace in our minds with everybody. If you want to practice the Mahayana tradition, if you want to be like His Holiness, then you have to make peace with everybody. Because, you can't have a Buddha that hates people. You can't have a bodhisattva that is biased and favors some people and scorns other people. This is something very nitty gritty about applying to our lives right now, because we, encounter people, and I like this one and I don't like that one. This one gives me presents, that one criticizes me. And we're full of opinions, and these people can come close, and these people get away. I'm reporting you to ICE, to what else can you report them to? Well, the police, but the police and ICE are cooperating. Okay, you can report them, to the teacher who's on kindergarten playground duty too, because that's the way our mind is very often when we get, when we don't like somebody, and this one's my best friend, we play hopscotch together, that one's a creep, they threw a ball at me. And we grow up, and we don't play hopscotch together, and hopefully we don't throw balls at each other, although some people might. You start with spitballs, So we don't do that, but we have the same kind of mind, don't we? It's like, these are the kind of people I like. So you better be one of them, or else I'm putting you on my list. Remember I told you about the list that my sixth grade class made, I'm putting you on the list and you're at the bottom. So we're adult, we don't go like this anymore. But in our mind we do, we act like little kids. Do we? We act like little kids. In adult bodies, we cover it up kind of nicely so it doesn't look so bad. But it's the same kind of mind. So we gotta work with that. Otherwise, we stamp our feet and, Mrs. Becker, he threw a spitball at me, Mrs. Becker, where's Mrs. Becker? Mrs. Becker, I threw the spitball at her because she always gives me dirty looks. Come on, you're supposed to solve the problem, Mrs. Becker. come on, you taught school, you gotta solve the problem. What are you gonna, what?
It's summer holidays.
It's summer holidays. Right. So then you go swimming and it's like, Mrs. Becker, he splashed water at me. You know, Mrs. Becker, I splashed water at her because she splashed water at me first. Yeah, so what are you going to say now? You've already pulled your hair out. Yeah.
Talk to your mother.
Talk to your mother. Right. Yeah. Okay. Anybody else? We have three nuns who used to be teachers. Any of you used to be teachers?
Hmm?
Who? And you've been? Okay, and Will. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And if you really act obnoxious, John's going to take care of you. Yeah. He's a judge. Yeah. And he's going to put you in jail. Yeah. Yeah. And then you'll come in and ask me for a get out of jail free card. I'm going to tell you, sorry, I don't play Monopoly anymore. Okay, so let's imagine the merit field in the space in front, ourselves surrounded by sentient beings who just want to be happy and not suffer, just like us, no different. And the people we don't like, right in front of us, they're also looking at the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas, and they too want to find a path and do a practice that will free them from their misery and confusion. So we're going to lead them in taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. So to generate bodhicitta, it's very helpful as a first step to understand how we ourselves are under the influence of afflictions and karma. Even though we feel like we're independent people who are in control of our minds and our actions, that's quite far from accurate. So everybody's in that situation. And when we can really clearly see how our afflictions and karma push us and create our experience, then we will want to be free of that. And when looking at others, we should see that it's the same thing with them. Yeah, their minds are overwhelmed by afflictions. They get pushed around to act in certain ways, to be in certain situations by their previous karma. So they're bound and trapped in samsara, just as we are. So to seek only our own liberation and forget about others doesn't seem right, does it? We could say, but I'm more important. Okay, give one logical reason that proves that. That we as one individual are more important than everybody else. That's going to be pretty hard to do, isn't it? So rather than seeking happiness and freedom from samsara for ourselves. We do it for everybody, because there's really no difference between us when it comes to important things like that. And yet we're very fortunate to have met the Dharma teachings. Not just met them, but heard them, studied them, tried to practice them. So since we have that advantage, we should use it to benefit all of us, ourselves and others. And we do that by setting our sights on full awakening, knowing that when we become fully awakened Buddhas, we will be most prepared to be of great benefit to each and every living being. So that's our motivation for sharing the teachings tonight and for the rest of our lives. Okay. So for those of you following the book, we're on page. Put your glasses on first.
If you can find them.
Okay, we're on page 173. We've been talking about restlessness and regret. Okay. So just a reminder of why these two come together. Yeah. His Holiness says they are separate mental factors. Yeah. But they're put together because they have the same cause, the same function, and the same antidote. Okay. So how do they have the same cause? Restlessness and regret. Okay. They're both caused by our preconceptions, our namtok. Yeah, the Tibetan term is namtok. In Sanskrit and Pali, it's prapancha. Yeah. Our minds are full of prapancha. Yeah, overflowing with preconceptions and namtok and, you know, the way we think things are, the way we think they should be. And so all of these act because we're thinking about our relatives, friends, homes, our past experiences, the good times we want in the future, all these things, we're thinking about them and having so many misconceptions about them. Okay, so the cause, yeah, preconceptions about all of our worldly things, our projects, our plans, our ideas about whatever. Okay, then they have the same function, which is they make the mind unsettled. When our mind's restless, when we have regret, our mind is not peaceful. And they have the same antidote, which in this case is serenity, generating some degree of concentration, yeah, that is able to turn our mind to a virtuous object. And then that subdues the regret and the restlessness, but those are only cut off by wisdom. Okay, so we talked about restlessness. Yeah, three types of restlessness. Physical restlessness. We are jumping and we are squirming and the things are going and not staying still. Okay. Yeah, we have verbal restlessness. We get caught up in singing, chatting, arguing over trivial topics. Yeah. How many jelly beans are in that jar? Yeah. Yeah, you counted them. Okay. Okay. So, and then mental restlessness. Yeah. Mind is ruminating. Yeah. Going round and around. You know, this person said this to me. What do they mean by saying that? They always treat me like that. This isn't fair. You know, it's always finger pointing. We never think, how was I involved in the situation? Did I push somebody else's button? No, we never think that. I am so innocent. Yeah. But this person's just, you know, they want to get my goat. And you know what? You give it to them. Okay. Do you have that expression in Singapore? No? Do you know what it means? Okay, well, you know what a goat is.
I know what you mean, but I don't think I use that.
You know what? What?
I know what you mean, but I don't think I use the same expression.
Okay, what?
Oh, we can't say what the expression is to ruin.
Yeah, it's rude. Okay, okay. Well, I guess we've reached a part where the conversation is censored. Okay. Okay, but you're here in America, so, you know, you can talk about getting people's goats. Yeah. Okay. What?
There's a new meaning for goat.
For goat? Oh, yeah, greatest of all times. Isn't it? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Goat, greatest of all times. Okay. So it could be greatest obnoxious of all times. Yeah. Okay. So that's reviewing restlessness, yeah. Then regret is an uncomfortable feeling that we did something we should not have done or did not do something we should have done. This is holiness, yeah. Regret is of two types. One, we spend time and energy in useless activities. When we realize how much time we have wasted, we feel remorse and worry that we'll never be able to meditate properly. Who has that? Yeah. We waste time and then we go, oh, I said I was not going to do this again and I just did it again. And you know, death is coming and I'm not using my time wisely. And, you know, how am I ever gonna have any success? So that's one kind of regret. The second one is after engaging in serious destructive karma, we feel overwhelmed with guilt and self-reproach. Anybody ever had that? Yeah. Okay, although regretting our misdeeds is virtuous, here the mind of guilt is unclear and it falls into unproductive and exaggerated guilt. You know, I'm so bad. Nobody else is as cuckoo as I am. Yeah. Okay. So both restlessness and regret take us into the past, longing for pleasures long gone, or worrying and guilty about actions done or not done. So we feel guilty about what we haven't done that we should have done. We feel guilty about what we have done that we shouldn't have done. Okay, so that's in the past, but both of these take us into the future. Restlessness, planning pleasurable experiences, regret, anxious about what could go wrong. Yeah, okay. Our thoughts are immersed in events that are not happening now, that either happened in the past or could happen in the future. So we're in the past, in our thoughts, in the future, in our thoughts. Okay. Yeah, papancha, it's a good one. Yeah, proliferations is a good English translation. Lama Yeshe called it superstitious thoughts. Okay. Observing our breath is one antidote to the flurry of agitated and remorseful thoughts. And so that's one thing. Stop, focus on your breath, get the mind to calm down, if you can. Yeah. Sometimes the mind is so wound up that you do one breath and then you're off ruminating again. Yeah. Mindfulness of the movements of the body helps to return attention to the present. Okay, so paying attention to our present physical, verbal, and mental activities alleviates fear about the future and remorse about the past, because we're not just focusing on what's happening around us, yeah, but what are our mental activities? Am I creating virtue? Am I creating non-virtue? Okay, so in being, as they say, you know, being here now, the title of a book that was quite well read, one in the day, yeah, okay. So we discover that the present is agreeable and full of opportunities to create virtue. So it's not just focusing on the present in the sense of, oh, look at this thermos. It's such a pretty color. The thermos is in the present, and I want it. I wonder who it belongs to. How can I hint to somebody that they should give me this thermos? Because when I have it, everybody will admire me for having this beautiful thermos, don't you think? Yeah, yeah, are you jealous? No? Oh, no. Okay, well, maybe not jealous. Are you envious?
She has a
bigger one. Oh, no. Oh, oh no, I gotta crawl in a hole. I'm worthless. I have such a small thermos. But small is good. Yeah, if you're big, your thermos just clunks around everything and disturbs everybody. Yeah, so you should want a small thermos. Bright pink. Yeah, okay. So, you know, it isn't that kind of focusing on the present. Yeah. Thinking about what we can get or what we can get rid of. It's, you know, looking at the mind and just making sure that it stays in a virtuous way. Yeah. Guilt is especially useless. It draws us into self-preoccupation in a most unhealthy way. Okay, so I think I've told some of you that I once led a retreat at Cloud Mountain, and in the discussion groups, we discuss guilt, you know, in the same way that we do. I ask questions and then We just, you know, went around in a circle. People talked about it. Okay. And in the process of discussing guilt, we divided into three groups, the ex-Catholics, the ex-Protestants, and the ex-Jews. Okay. And at the end of the discussion, we compared notes about who had the most guilt. Yeah, because some of us in the cultures we're raised in, yeah, we are raised with guilt. Yeah, and guilt is a good weapon to apply to a kid. Yeah, makes them feel terrible and they'll be obedient. Yeah, either that or they'll rebel and, you know, do who knows what. Okay, so here's what Nagarjuna counsels about guilt. If you feel regret for, now regret and guilt are different, okay? Regret is, I made a mistake, I regret it. Yeah, guilt is, I'm such an awful person, I don't want anybody to know about this. Okay, I'm irredeemable. Okay, so if you feel regret for an offense, having regretted it, put it down and let it go. Okay? So regret there is a virtuous mental factor because we're regretting a negative action that we did. And it's also the first of the four opponent powers that we need to use to purify negative karma. Okay? But when we regret things, we don't fall into guilt. Yeah, there's no self-blame, I'm such a horrible person with regret. So he said, having regretted it, put it down and let it go. In this way, the mind abides peaceful and happy. Do not constantly remain attached to it in your thoughts. Yeah, but there's some things that we've done that we really regret, and we keep coming back to them again and again. Okay. If we keep coming back to them because we have sincere regret and we want to really make a strong determination not to engage with that action again, then that's okay. Keep coming back to it. Yeah. But if we come back to it and we sit there and we just stew in guilt, that accomplishes nothing. Yeah, we should just put it down. If you possess the two kinds of regret, of having not done what you should have done, or having done what you should not have done, because this regret attaches to the mind, it is the mark of a foolish person. Okay. So when the regret goes overboard and turns into prapancha, ruminating, yeah, preconceptions, self-blame, all that nice stuff, right? That we're very much in the habit of doing, that kind of negative self-talk. Okay, so getting caught in that, that's the mark of a foolish person. It is not the case that on account of feeling guilty, you will somehow be able to do what you failed to do. Okay, so feeling guilty doesn't undo the fact that you didn't do what you should have done. And it doesn't undo the fact that you did what you shouldn't have done. Yeah, guilt. And this is the thing that is very, if you've been raised in a family or a culture where guilt is there, this is the tricky thing about it, is when we feel guilty and we go on this, you know, tirade about what a horrible person we are, yeah, who's the star of the show? Yeah, we are. Yeah. Does that feeling guilty and that kind of self-deprecation Does it do anything good? No. But the thing that's tricky about it is if you've been raised with guilt, you think that somehow the guiltier you feel, the more you are atoning for your negative action. Yeah. And that's how guilt kind of hooks you in. Yeah. If I keep hating myself and telling myself what a failure I am and telling myself, you know, not only does the world treat me wrong, you know, and it's unfair, but, you know, something's wrong with me and da 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 da. Yeah. It, you know, it doesn't solve anything. And we think that it, because we feel lousy, we think that the lousier I make myself feel, the more I'm purifying my negativity. Are you getting what I'm saying? Everybody have that mechanism inside your mind? Yeah. So that this is the what we have to catch with guilt, because if we don't, then we just, you know, stay in our guilty state. Yeah, thinking that somehow by feeling so terrible, what a horrible person I am. Not what a horrible deed I did. Yeah, you're not regretting the action so much as saying I'm a horrible person. So you keep saying I'm horrible, I'm horrible. What are people going to think of me? I don't want them to know. Something's wrong with me. I always make a mess. Yeah. In there, in all of that self-talk, is there any regret for the action that we did? No. There's no regret. Yeah. So it doesn't, that kind of guilt doesn't, you know, any guilt doesn't purify. It isn't the same as regret. Yeah. It just makes us spiral down, you know, where we dig ourselves a nice big hole, yeah, and decorate it with, instead of affirming statements, you know, with, I am a failure, everything I touch is bad, you know, I can't do anything right, nobody loves me, everybody hates me, think I'll eat some worms, you know, we decorate it like that. And then we stew. Wonderful, isn't it? Does that purify anything? No. It just wastes a lot of time. Yeah. So we have to really regret our non-virtues. Yeah. If we rejoice in our non-virtue, we may do gazillion Vajrasattva mantra. But whenever we think of, oh God, I said that to that person, I got them, good. Yeah, and you keep coming back, you know, you feel a little bit of pride, a little bit of, yeah, I showed them, yeah. Then you may do so many Vajrasattva, but you're not purifying anything because there's no regret. Okay. Generating the type of regret involved in purification is useful. Having sincerely performed the four opponent powers, we can release self-reproach and guilt. Yeah, okay. So that is about restlessness and regret. Okay, now the next one, deluded doubt. Yeah. Okay. So doubt is indecisiveness. Yeah. And there's different kinds of doubt. Okay. But with all of them, we can't make up our mind. Yeah. We're the turkey sitting on the fence when Thanksgiving is approaching. Yeah. Okay. So one type of doubt involves seeking answers to genuine questions we have about the path or the meditation technique. Yeah, that doubt invites curiosity and can usually be cleared up by consulting our spiritual mentor or a knowledgeable Dharma friend, or looking up the topic that we have doubt about. Okay, so that kind of doubt isn't negative. It invites curiosity. Yeah, you want to learn. Okay, another type of doubt, yeah, a useless spinning of thoughts is deluded. Okay, so this doubt, okay, we have so many options to choose from that we get caught in doubt. Should I go to this Dharma center or that one? Should I rely on this teacher or that one? Should I ordain? Am I doing this meditation correctly? How long should my meditation sessions be? Okay. So that's doubt involving Dharma. We also have doubt about worldly things. Should I take this job? Should I take that job? Maybe I shouldn't take any job. Okay. Should I collect Social Security now, you know, at 62? Should I wait until 65? Should I wait even longer? When should I collect my Social Security? You know, and then you go round and around and around about doubt like this, okay? I applied for this program. Will I get in or won't I get in? If I get in, will I go? If I don't get in, what will I do? I could go there, I could go there. I could go up or down. I don't know what to do. Anybody ever been in that state? Okay, we can stay in that state of deluded doubt for a long time, and it completely immobilizes us. Yeah, that's why I like the image of a turkey standing on the fence, not knowing whether to jump there or to jump on the other side of the fence or to walk forward or to go backwards. Yeah. But Thanksgiving is coming, and it's not so safe to be a turkey out in public, yeah, when Thanksgiving is coming. But you don't even care about Thanksgiving. You're just immersed in your doubt as a turkey, yeah? Do I peck this piece, this crumb, or that crumb, yeah? Okay, so we may doubt our abilities or doubt that it is possible to actualize our spiritual goals. We are mired in the quicksand of indecision and confusion. Yeah, because you can see how doubt is very immersed with confusion. Yeah, because you can't think clearly. And every time you start to, you just get more confused. Deluded doubt, so this is a particular kind of doubt. Deluded doubt specifically concerns Dharma teachings. It seems that rebirth doesn't exist. I'm not sure, but it sounds like emptiness means nothingness. Is it really possible to become a Buddha? Isn't that just fantasy and wishful thinking? And then you circle again. It seems that rebirth doesn't exist. Is that true? Is that not true? How about emptiness? Is it nothingness? Yeah. There's all this talk about Buddhahood. What kind of nonsense is that? Yeah. They talk about negative karma and going to hell. It sounds like Catholic catechism all over again. Yeah. Alex Burson told me one time he was teaching a course, and one guy came to see him. You know, he was quite immersed in doubt. He didn't know what he believed, you know, and he had grown up Catholic. and just, you know, learning Buddhism. Is this true? Is this not true? And then he said to Alex, I'm afraid if I believe in Buddhism, I'm going to go to Catholic hell. But I'm afraid that if I go back to Catholicism, I'm going to go to Buddhist hell. Yeah? This is the pickle we get ourselves into with deluded doubt. Yeah? Yeah. How do you answer a question like that? Yeah. Okay. So appearing so real and important, doubt immobilizes us. It's like trying to sew with a two-pointed needle. You can't go this way and we can't go that way. Yeah, can you imagine trying to stitch something with a needle with two points? You stick it in and it can't go anywhere. Yeah, it's stuck, and that's what doubt does to us. We get so stuck. Okay. Deluded doubt inhibits generating the faith and confidence in the three jewels that makes our mind receptive to learning and practicing the Dharma. Yeah. Do the three jewels exist? I don't know. Does talk about Buddha? Yeah. Does Buddha exist? Does God exist? Are they the same? I don't know. Okay. So we're confused. Okay. Our mind is not receptive to hearing the teachings because we're just going like this. Okay. As a result of our confusion and our deluded doubt, even if we meet the Buddha Dharma and encounter an excellent spiritual master, the benefit we receive from them is lost to us. Yeah, because we're just stuck in our doubt. Mm-hmm. We resemble somebody who goes to a land of great wealth, but lacking a bag, is unable to take anything away with them. Yeah, you're exposed to the Dharma, but you're so mired in your own confusion and doubt that you can't really take anything in. Yeah. One of the big things people often doubt about in the West is rebirth. Yeah. And His Holiness, he tries to help people, kind of lighten up on that doubt by saying, okay, you may not have, rebirth exists or it doesn't exist. But, okay, if you say that it doesn't exist, there's no rebirth, and you live your life like that, at the end of your life, if there's no rebirth, nothing lost, nothing gained, yeah. But if you get to the end of your life and there is rebirth, but you lived your life as if there weren't, then what? Yeah, if you live your life without any idea about rebirth, without any idea of ethical conduct, you're going to have a whole sack of negative karma. Yeah. But His Holiness said, yeah, if you still don't need to decide about rebirth, but if you kind of, think on the positive way, yeah, rebirth could exist. Then if there's no rebirth when you die, you haven't lost anything. And if there is rebirth when you die, you're prepared for it. Yeah. So he said, given that choice, it's probably good to kind of, in your doubt, tend towards accepting rebirth. Yeah. It's not going to hurt you. Whereas saying, oh, when I die, there's nothing. Yeah, that kind of view can hurt us. Yeah. Because if we say, there's nothing, then we give ourselves permission to just act and do whatever we want. And the only criteria is don't get caught. know? And then we do all sorts of stuff. Yeah. And, you know, some of the inmates that I've written to, this is the kind of doubt where they get stuck, you know. They don't see any future for themselves, you know, let alone thinking about future lives. Their life so far has been so limited and with so much misery that the only future they can see is to have happen what happens to, you know, many people in your hood, you know, in the neighborhood, and what has happened to your parents. And so what is that? Drug abuse, yeah, acting out, guns, prison, yeah. And so, you know, that's one of the things in working with young people is they have to have some vision of a future that they want that is possible for them. Okay. So while not all forms of doubt inhibit gaining serenity, three foremost ones do. Okay, so doubt inhibits us taking in the Dharma, yeah, but of course it's going to inhibit serenity because we sit down to meditate and then we start doubting, you know, can I really receive serenity? Is this the right method to do it? What is serenity? What's it going to feel like? I have no idea. Okay. So three foremost kinds of doubt. First one, doubt in ourselves prevents us from trying. I'm not capable of this. My intelligence is limited, and the defilements and the seeds of destructive karma obscuring my mind are just too great. Okay? So I don't try because I'm not going to be able to succeed. Yeah? Because my mind is just too much of a mess and I can't think clearly and anyway. Okay? So such unrealistic self-denigrating thoughts paralyze us. The opportunity to act to improve our situation, especially by employing the mind training methods, is always present. Yeah. So to tell ourselves, you know, I have too many afflictions, too many problems, you know, I can't do it. Yeah. What His Holiness is saying is the mind training teachings are there. And what is mind training? What's the strong point? Teaching us how to take adversity into the path. So if you practice those teachings, then you're able to, you know, do something about that self-denigration. And if you, you know, remember that you have the Buddha potential. Hmm? Okay. So that possibility of improving the state of our mind is always there. Signing off on ourselves doesn't make any sense. Okay, second kind of doubt. Doubt in our spiritual mentor. Does this arises from looking only at his or her superficial characteristics with a judgmental attitude? My spiritual mentor's behavior is nothing special. He or she doesn't have any realizations of the path. So what will I gain from following them? Yeah, I can tell. They have no realizations. They slurp their noodles. Yeah? They don't have very good manners. Somebody who slurps their noodles doesn't have the basis of ethical conduct. How are they going to get, you know, realizations? Yeah, I mean, if you've been raised in certain cultures, these kinds of things with manners matter, and you're going to judge somebody. Yeah? Okay. They said my spiritual mentor was Buddha. Well, if they are, they should know how to get us to Spokane. I asked them for directions. They don't know. Yeah. And they can't drive a car. And they don't even want to drive a car. They want to drive a motorcycle. What kind of spiritual mentor is that that wants to drive a motorcycle? Geshe Dado. Yeah, don't you remember in the monasteries in South India? Yeah, maybe not a motorcycle, but a scooter. Yeah, the monks want scooters because they have to go places. Yeah, oh, you know, my teacher should be a perfect monk and walk barefoot. Yeah, that's what they did at the time of the Buddha. Why does he want to ride a scooter? Yeah. We judge people, don't we? We have our ideas of what a perfect spiritual mentor is. And on some little thing, we just say, you know, this person doesn't know anything. Okay, he or she doesn't have any realizations of the path. So what will I gain from following them? Considering ourselves wise enough to evaluate our spiritual mentor's practice, we are blind to our own arrogance. What a sentence. Yeah. Did you ever think about that when you're criticizing somebody? Yeah. I am so knowledgeable. I know everybody's motivations. I know everybody's level of practice. Yeah, that's arrogance on our part, isn't it? So to free ourselves from this doubt, Nagarjuna recommends that we think of gold in a smelly pouch. Okay, so there's this bright, shiny gold inside some pouch that is, I don't know, like old rotten leather that stinks. It's been rolled in rancid butter. Yeah. Go to Tibet. Yeah. This is what they had in old Tibet. Okay. If we want the gold, we have to take the pouch too. Okay. Then, instead of dwelling on the mentor's shortcomings, we reflect that our, if we want the gold, we have to take the pouch too. Then, instead of dwelling on the mentor's shortcomings, we reflect that our mentor is instructing us in the Buddha's teachings, just as the Buddha himself would do. Rather than focus on the pouch, we direct our interest to the gold inside. Yeah. So we take what is valuable, what we can learn from that person. The smelly pouch, you know, it holds the gold, but we don't have to put our attention on that. Okay, the third kind of doubt here that inhibits serenity is doubt in the Dharma. So this makes us wonder if Buddhahood and the path to attain it exist. Not knowing how to think clearly about the topic, our mind swirls in confusion. Yeah. Does Buddhahood exist? Is it possible? My science teacher said that we are hardwired to be self-centered. But Buddhism says you can develop bodhicitta, and to do that, you have to overcome your self-centeredness. Is it possible to overcome my self-centeredness? My science teacher says no. Yeah, because it's rooted in my amygdala, and I don't want to take my amygdala out right now. And I haven't heard of any places where I can train, you know, exchange my amygdala for one that isn't so thinking about myself. So I don't know if I can practice that. I mean, we can't think clearly. We're just like a mess. So we need some patience. It's unrealistic to think that all of our questions must be answered before we can do any Dharma practice at all. Okay? So you have a list of questions, and pages and pages of questions, and you're telling yourself, I can't practice the Dharma unless I get answers to my questions. Yeah. And then you corner your teacher. Yeah. And it's like, okay, yeah. What about this? What about this? What about this? I need answers to all of them. Otherwise, I can't practice. Yeah. I think I told you about the time, this was early on in my practice, I had been serving as the previous Song Rinpoche as his cook when he was in Los Angeles. And then I went back to India, he went back to India. And I was thinking about the teachings he had given on emptiness when in Los Angeles. And I was thinking about that, and I didn't understand, you know, it's like, I don't, you know, emptiness, it's important, but I don't understand this. So I went to see him in Dharamsala, and I asked, you know, a few of my questions, all as one question, you know. Yeah. You know, one of those questions where it lasts for like 3 to 5 minutes. Yeah. And Rinpoche looked at me and he said, well, I don't think you'd understand the answers to any of them. But anyway, you're here, so I'll tell you something. And then he responded to it. Yeah. I was thinking about this. I have those notes somewhere. I should really dig them out, yeah, and see what he said. Yeah. But he was so kind because, you know, I was new. Yeah, and what, he's going to start telling me, well, the Vibhasikas say this and the Chittamajans say that. And, you know, I'm not going to understand. Okay. So by practicing what we understand, we increase our respect in the teachings and open our minds to understanding other topics. Okay? So if we practice what we do understand, then gradually we are purifying our mind, we are accumulating merit, and we will understand more in the future. Yeah. Okay, here's some more advice from Nagarjuna. Just as when a person stands at a fork in the road and is so confused by doubt that he goes nowhere at all, when you seek realization of the true character of phenomena, doubt acts in just the same way. So in our life, you know, you're at a turning point, you just graduated, whatever you graduated from, or you just stopped whatever you were doing. Now what do I do? Do this, do I do that? So there's your worldly doubt. But then in the Dharma, you know, when you look at you're investigating the true nature of phenomena, how do they exist? Well, yeah, when I search for them, I can't find what they are, but there's got to be something that they are, because I see them and they function. But if I search for that, I can't find it. So do they have their own nature or don't they have their own nature? Yeah, is this a clock or isn't it a clock? Yeah. One Lama tells me to look for the clock in this thing, I can't find it. But then another Lama says, please bring me the clock. I need to know what time it is. So is there a clock or is there not a clock? What do I do? Yeah, do I bring him a clock? Okay, so doubt acts in the same way. Yeah. Because you remain doubtful, you don't diligently seek to realize the true character of phenomena. Yeah? So this is really something he's saying. When we're full of doubt, we don't really think about, we don't put our mind to think about things logically, and so we never clear up our doubt. We don't ask questions, so we never gain more information, so we can't clear up our doubt. Yeah? So this doubt comes forth from confusion. Among all the detrimental mental factors, it is the worst. Do you think it's really the worst, this kind of doubt? Yeah, because, you know, anger is really bad. If you get angry, you destroy so much merit. Yeah, so is doubt worse than anger? Yeah, but what about attachment? You know, when we study the four truths, what's the example for true suffering and true, or for true causes? It's craving. Yeah, craving makes the samsaric world go round. Yeah, so maybe craving is the worst one. Yeah, but anger destroys all that merit. But here he's saying doubt is the worst one. I don't know. What do you think? Yeah. How many vote for craving? How many vote for anger? Do we have any idea what we're voting for? Yeah. So when you're confused like that, you can't slow your mind down enough to really learn anything, you know? Although you may possess doubts while abiding in the world, you should still accord with the sublime and virtuous Dharma. So you may not be so sure if the law of karma and its effects exists, but you still should accord with the sublime and virtuous Dharma and not be an obnoxious brat. Not be a jerk. Yeah? That's what he's saying. Just as when you contemplate a fork in the road, you should follow that path which is most beneficial. But I don't know which one is most beneficial. Please tell me. And, you know, and your teacher says, take the one on the right. I don't want to take that one. Yeah, that one doesn't look so good. So you go, another teacher says, well, then take the one on the left. You're like, I don't want to take that one either. You know, well, what do you do? What do you want to do? I don't know. Yeah, tell me what to do. Well, I just did, you know, but you don't want to do it. So, okay. So that's the mind of doubt. It's so stuck. Okay, so now something about a summary about the five hindrances. The five hindrances are subsumed in the three poisons. What are the three poisons? Ignorance, attachment, anger. Okay. So the five hindrances are subsumed in the three poisons and are related to the 84,000 afflictions. Yeah, you've got 84,000 afflictions. Okay, I have 84,008 afflictions. I'm worse than anybody else. I have more afflictions. Yeah, God made me this way. Yeah, okay. So the hindrance of sensual desire is the poison of attachment. And the hindrance of malice is the poison of anger. Okay. The hindrances of lethargy and sleepiness and doubt are the poison of, OK? confusion, yeah, which is another word for ignorance, yeah. And the hindrance of restlessness and regret is based on all three. Yeah. Okay. So these four categories, attachment, anger, confusion, and all three, each of those subsume 21,000 afflictions for a total of 84,000 afflictions. There's four categories. Each category has 21,000 afflictions. Okay. By applying antidotes to the three poisons and five hindrances, all afflictions are overcome. Wow, that sounds much easier than doing 21,000 for each, doesn't it? Yeah. But we've got to really penetrate in our practice. So Zhi, who is one Chinese sage who wrote a text about how to attain serenity, he says that a practitioner who has successfully suppressed these five hindrances through serenity is like a person who has recovered from a threatening disease. Wow, that person feels good. They're like a famished person arriving in a land of plenty. They're like a hostage being released from terrorists. Her mind is peaceful, responsive, clear, and blissful. This is how serenity makes the mind. Suppressing afflictions through serenity gives us temporary respite from the pain of and suffering of the afflictions, but only insight into emptiness will eradicate the afflictions forever. Okay, then there's a reflection. So this is your homework. Yeah. So review the five hindrances, and for each one, contemplate. One, what is the meaning of this hindrance? Two, how does it interrupt concentration? And three, pinpoint examples of it in your own experience. Yeah. And which one of the five is the most troublesome for you? And a fourth question, which we should add, is what's the antidote to apply to that affliction? Yeah. And will you apply it? Because often we know the antidote, but I don't want to apply that antidote. I don't like thinking about that. Yeah. You could actually write that down for when they reprint the book to add the fourth point of what is the antidote for the hindrance that is most troublesome for you, and added to that question is will you practice it? Okay, so let's pause here. There questions, comments about what we've done so far? Five hindrances. Mm-hmm.
So, Venerable, I tend to cling to the past. And when I bring certain experiences into my analytic meditation, I can't tell if what I am doing is useful or if I'm just finding inventive ways to obsess over them.
Wait, say that again.
When I bring certain experiences into my analytic meditation,
yeah,
I can't tell if what I'm doing is useful or if I'm just finding inventive ways to obsess over them.
Okay, so you feel like the meditating on Lam Rim or thought training is just I'm making excuses to try and get my mind to not think about that, like that.
Yes, yeah. Example, like that.
Okay. The way to overcome that, I think, is just to do it, to do the practice, put the doubt aside, do the practice, and as you do it and become familiar with the thought training practice for whatever the antidote is to that affliction, as you become familiar with that, it really begins to make some sense in your mind, and then you see that it affects the strength of the affliction, and it affects how quickly the affliction will come up. Okay, but if you just say, if you're stuck in doubt, is what I'm doing useful, or am I just making up excuses, then you're not really going to engage with meditating on the antidote. Yeah. Okay. So you have to, you know, in the case of anger, if that's coming up, then you have to take out, you know, at least one of the antidotes that Shanti Dev has talked about, or that's, you know, summarized, will be in the next volume. Yeah, and practice it. That it's, what is it? It's like you have to taste something to know if it tastes good. You get what I mean? Like, I could tell you, yes, the antidote will work, but that's not going to solve your doubt. It's like me saying, yes, this thing that they served for dessert, you know, you don't, yes, this thing they served for dessert, yes, it's very tasty. Yeah, that's not going to give you confidence to taste it. You're not going to know if it tastes good or not. You're going to have to taste it. And then maybe you go, oh, it looks terrible, but it tastes good. Or maybe you taste it, it looks good, but bleh. Yeah. Or maybe, you know, your friend likes it, but you don't. That's okay. Yeah. So your friend may apply one antidote to, let's say, anger or craving or whatever, but you may find one of the other antidotes more effective. But you have to really do it to see, okay? And then you'll see if it's useful. Mm-hmm. Okay, I know for me, when I first started applying the antidotes, the first step for me is I had to want to do something with this affliction. Yeah, if I didn't really want to do it, and I was just doing it because I thought I should, it didn't work. Okay, so then even if I wanted to do something, because that affliction's driving me crazy, I had to also be able to prove to myself why the way that affliction was seeing things is incorrect. Okay, so for, let's say, attachment, yeah? Okay, so, you know, initially attachment feels really good. You know, you can daydream all you want about getting what you think is going to make you happy. But at a certain point you go, I'm so sick and tired about daydreaming about this, and I'm just wasting a lot of time, and I want to do something about it, okay? So you want to change it, okay? But are my daydreams really afflictive? I mean, when I daydream, aren't I setting goals for myself? And my high school counselor told me I should set goals for myself. And at the graduation speech, you know, everybody who gives graduation speech tells the graduates, you know, dream big, actualize your dreams. So that's what I'm doing when I'm daydreaming. You know, I'm thinking of what I want and how I'm going to get it. So what's wrong with that? Yeah. Yeah. Shouldn't I be doing that? And then you think you've heard a little bit of teachings. Yeah. Well, attachment is based on exaggerating the good quality of someone or something and then clinging to it. Is that happening in my mind when I'm thinking, daydreaming about, you know, everything I want to do, everything I want to have, everything I want to be? Am I exaggerating in my mind? Yeah, and I had to, you know, really prove to myself, okay, let's take something before that I daydreamed about, okay? And, you know, I got it and did it alleviate all my restlessness and all my craving, and did it make me happy? No. It made me happy for a minute, but, you know, oh yeah, I remember my teacher said, once you have a computer, you have computer hell. Once you have a car, you have car hell. Yes, I was exaggerating, yeah? And then when I could see clearly that, then, you know, meditating on impermanence, yeah, meditating on the disadvantages of samsara and so forth, then that really, those things acted as a good antidote. Okay, same with anger. I had to really prove to myself that my anger was not seeing the situation correctly. Because I was sure when I was angry, I was seeing it correctly. And it was the people I was fighting with, or the person I was fighting with, who had the incorrect idea. But my anger is correct because I'm fighting for truth and happiness. Yeah, and the American way. So whatever thing I think is correct. Yeah, and I had, you know, so my anger is correct. And I had to really, you know, sit and think about that. When I'm angry, am I seeing the situation correctly? And then you start to think, well, whose viewpoint am I seeing the situation from when I'm angry? Mine. Whose happiness is most important when I'm angry? Mine. Who's right? Me. Who's wrong? Them. Does this make me happy thinking this way? Not really. Okay. And then you can really get into meditating on the antidotes. Okay. Yeah. And if you don't like the answer, I heard that they our new chief of health, you know, that they're going to, the FDA is going to legitimize a new pill that they've come out with, which is the anti-anger pill. Yes, and it's pink, yeah. And then they're coming out with an anti-attachment pill. Yeah, that's blue, bright blue. Yeah. The anti-ignorance pill, they're having some trouble with. But you know, science will solve everything. Yeah, so you can think that if you don't like the answer I just gave. Okay. Yeah.
I find it helpful for myself during purifying stuff and at past actions and when we, you know, we're supposed to give ourselves a timeline, like, oh, I'm going to try not to do this for
I'm so glad.
Oh, when we purify and then we set a timeline, you know, I try not to do this for X amount of time. Mm-hmm. Many times, if it's like habitual, like the critical mind or the, I often tell myself moment to moment, and that helps me keep more aware of my mind.
Yep.
It's just a daily reminder to, you know,
yep.
That's track my
good.
Mind.
And that's much more practical.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. Because I don't, you know, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Anything else? No doubts. Yeah, crystal clear. Okay, and we'll dedicate. So please do the, you know, this reflection here and contemplate the, you know, really get, be able to identify each of the five hindrances in your own experience and then practice the antidotes to them. Hmm?